This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The Trump administration has joined dozens of allies who have rallied around Britain, expelling scores of Russian diplomats and/or spies. To Russia, it's just proof that it's a victim of a bullying West. The West says that Russia has been pushing and pushing, from the invasion of Crimea to interference in elections to unleashing a deadly chemical agent on the streets of Britain. This hour on Point, the standoff with Russia and where it's headed. You can join us on air or online. Is this a new low post-Cold War relations with Russia? Is it time for the West to put its foot down? What about President Trump's long reluctance to call out President Putin? Later in this hour, we're going to remember Linda Brown, the face and the spirit of the landmark case Brown v. Board of Education. But joining me first from Washington is Shannon Pettypiece. She's White House correspondent for Bloomberg. And Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
So this mass expulsion of Russian diplomats, it's the largest ever, bigger than anything that happened during the days of the Cold War, I'm reading. Tell us what we know about how this decision came down in the White House.
So our reporting indicates that on Wednesday of last week, there was a meeting of the National Security Council. All the advisors came together to discuss some options that the different agencies within sort of the intelligence community and the foreign policy community had been discussing for weeks, if not months at this point, as far as how to respond to this increasing Russian aggression, not just this chemical attack in the UK, but, of course, the election interference in the U.S. and the UK, or in Europe, and of course, even going back further to their invasion of Crimea. But the chemical attack was certainly a ratcheting up of concern. They met on Wednesday. They presented an option to the president on Friday, that this option that was announced on Monday, the president agreed to it. And they've been working with our allies since to sort of really coordinate the rollout of these pressures.
So yesterday, the Trump administration put out a statement. Today's action makes the U.S. safer by reducing Russia's ability to spy on Americans and to conduct covert operations that threaten Americans' national security. Can you describe who is being expelled and to what extent these expulsions will degrade Russia's intelligence abilities in the U.S.?
Well, and a big part of this is, so there's the 60 Russians who are being expelled, about a dozen of those at the United Nations. There is the closing of the consulate in Seattle. That could be significant because when the consulate in San Francisco was closed, we found out, and there was some reporting by others that indicated, that consulate was really being used to, sort of spy on our tech infrastructure, our fiber optics infrastructure, our tech community. Seattle is, of course, home to Boeing, Amazon, also another tech hotbed. So the closure of that, I think, is significant. Number 60 is the most since the Cold War. It could have been higher. It could go higher at some point. But it really, if nothing else, is a symbol to Russia that the U.S., with its allies, united, coordinated efforts here to show that they're not going to stand by and let Russia, behave poorly anymore like this when it comes to our allies.
And Shannon, talk to us about the role of President Trump in all of this. I mean, the president, of course, has appeared eager over many months to have good relations with President Putin. He's been reluctant to criticize him. Just last week, he congratulated him for his reelection victory. So far, he hasn't spoken out or tweeted about this action. So is there a sort of dual track here? I mean, on the one hand, President Trump not speaking out particularly forcefully on this while his administration does.
Well, this was his decision at the end of the day as a president. He is, you know, always in conversations with, you know, the Secretary of State, the other members of his cabinet who are involved in this decision. But this was really a decision that was reached by the foreign policy community, that was presented to him, and one that he, you know, he agreed to. But, you know, we saw with Secretary of State, you know, Tillerson, in his final hours, really, as Secretary of State, coming out and taking a very strong stance against Russia and saying that this strategy of trying to develop a relationship with them that the administration has taken for the past year has not been working, that he has tried to develop a positive relationship with them, and it's just not happening. You know, you could see his frustration and him take a turn in tone there hours before he was fired. We have not yet seen that from the president, though. The president still, as far as his public comments, have indicated that he thinks, and I believe his last tweet indicated this, that a productive relationship with Russia is still possible. And, of course, this was something that, when reporters asked, he did not bring up on the call with Putin, this chemical attacks, not to mention the election hacking that's been going on around the world.
So, Shannon, what's next? I mean, what's next in terms of possible actions by the U.S.? What do you anticipate from Russia? What questions are you eager to get an answer to in the coming hours or days?
Well, the big one we're waiting for is to find out how Russia responds. It, you know, could take them a few days to come up with a plan that they can really quickly pull the trigger on. So we'll be watching for that. In the past, their response has been reciprocal. You know, we kick X number out of the U.S., they kick X number out of Russia. But the response to the U.K. was a bit more than reciprocal. You know, initially when the U.K. took action, you know, the Russians went beyond what the U.K.'s action was. So we could see something stronger come from them. And then the issue is, do we just get in a back-and-forth tit-for-tat? And there's a lot more the U.S. could do at this point than expelling 60 Russians. I mean, we could be talking about more consulate closures, embassy closures. I mean, the ultimate would be kicking everyone out of our country, you know, all the diplomats out of our country. So, I mean, that's ultimately where things could end. And, of course, then you get back into this sort of Cold War style mentality that a lot of people have been wanting to avoid in this administration.
All right. That's Shannon Pettypiece. She's White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
So let's listen to a little tape from this week. Here was U.S. Ambassador to Moscow John Huntsman yesterday explaining the new U.S. measures to the Russian people.
The United States takes this action in conjunction with our NATO allies and partners around the world in response to a military-grade chemical weapon attack on the soil of the United Kingdom by Russia. The United States is ready to cooperate and forge a better relationship between our two countries. But that will only be possible when Russia chooses to become a more responsible partner.
And here's British Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday speaking to the House of Commons, announcing the concerted response by some 27 nations to the nerve agent attack on British soil.
18 countries have announced their intention to expel more than 100 Russian intelligence officers from their countries. This includes 15 EU member states, as well as the United States, Canada, and the Ukraine. And this is the largest collective expulsion of Russian intelligence officers in history.
Let's go now to Moscow to Natalia Vasilyeva, who is the Moscow correspondent for the Associated Press. And Natalia, welcome to On Points. Good to have you.
Hi, thank you. It's Natalia.
Natalia, so sorry about that. How has the Russian government responded to these expulsions?
Well, there was quite a bit of an official response yesterday, but it was mostly verbal. Both the Kremlin and the foreign ministry had some harsh words to say about how Britain did not have any evidence of Russia's role behind the poisoning. They also mentioned how they think Britain and the United States particularly pressured some of the EU members to expel diplomats. But so far, we have not heard a single announcement of what actual steps Moscow is going to take. And I think the explanation is quite clear. You know, we need to put things into perspective because The whole Russia is grieving over the victims of the deadly fire in Siberia, which has killed more than 60 people, and dozens of them are children. So the entire country, it seems, is paralyzed by grief, and President Putin called for a day of mourning tomorrow. So I think it's very unlikely that we're going to hear get a particular reaction, the actual set of measures Moscow is going to take today or any time tomorrow.
Right. So yesterday the Kremlin put out a statement. It goes without saying that this unfriendly move by this group of countries will not go unnoticed, and we will respond to it. Natalia, what does that mean to you, a statement like that? I mean, does this mean a tit-for-tat expulsion? Is this going to accelerate tensions between these two countries? Where do you see it going?
We're definitely expecting tit-for-tat expulsions, as we have seen in the past, when, for example, the outgoing Obama administration ordered for the expulsion of Russian diplomats on New Year's Eve. However, Moscow retaliated only months later, but they did expel the same number of diplomats as the U.S. expelled a couple of months ago. We also could be expecting a closure of one of the consulates, and the Russian embassy in Washington, actually, they run a Twitter account, and they held a poll on its Twitter page offering to its followers to choose which American consulate should be closed as one of those tit-for-tat measures.
That's Natalieva Vasilieva. Natalia Vasilieva. She's a correspondent for the Associated Press, speaking to us from Moscow about what can only be described as a new low in post-Cold War relations between Russia and the West. Natalia, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
When we return, we'll go back to Washington and to Berlin to take a closer look at this growing standoff with Russia. You can join the conversation. What's the danger that this will escalate? How far will it go? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the West's big concerted action against Russia and how the U.S. is playing a part in that push, despite President Trump's unusual approach to U.S.-Russia relations. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Has the president changed his mind on Moscow? Do you think his national security staff forced his hand on this? And what do you want to see come out of this? So here's United Kingdom Prime Minister Theresa May speaking to British lawmakers on March 14th, the day that the UK expelled 23 Russian diplomats in retaliation for the nerve attack against a former Russian spy on British soil.
There is no alternative conclusion other than that the Russian state was culpable for the attempted murder of Mr. Skripal and his daughter, and for threatening the lives of other British citizens in Salisbury, including Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey. This represents an unlawful use of force by the Russian state against the United Kingdom.
Now, that same day, Alexander Vladimirovich Yakovenko, the Russian ambassador to the United Kingdom, condemned the UK's action.
I had just a meeting in the Foreign Office. I said that everything what is done today by the British government is absolutely unacceptable, and we consider this a provocation.
Joining me now from Germany, from Berlin, is John Kornblum. He is, it's fair to say, one of the country's old Cold Warriors. He has served in high-level diplomatic posts with a focus on Russia in Europe going back to the Nixon administration. Now he's a senior counselor to the international law firm Knorr LLP. John Kornblum, it's good to have you back on Point. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is Michael Crowley. He's senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and he joins us from Washington. Michael, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
John Kornblum, let me start with you, and I'd love to just get your reaction to this big coordinated expulsion of these Russian diplomats. This kind of alliance-wide cooperation isn't always something one can count on. What do you think?
No, that's true. And I think the most important part of this reaction is this wide consensus among 15 European countries, the United States, Canada, Australia, et cetera, et cetera. I think what we see here is sort of, you know, the last straw, as we would say it. Ever since really 2013, certainly 2014, when he invaded Crimea, Putin has been trying to be a disruptive force in relations with the West, not a positive but a disruptive one. There are lots of theories about that. He needs it for his internal position, whatever the truth is. And the West has been getting more and more angry all the time. Western politicians have been criticized more and more for putting up with it. You have the whole question of hacking elections. You have this poisoning. You have still the situation in Ukraine. The list of issues goes on and on. And I think this was probably a case of where the West just said, enough's enough. Let's show him that we're not as weak and uncoordinated as he thinks we are.
You know, it's interesting, again, just to stick with this idea of this concerted and coordinated response among the Western allies. I mean, it's not something we could take for granted. Countries like Germany and Italy joined this, which might be surprising because they've had pretty good relations with Moscow. But you're suggesting a sort of new level of frustration that has sort of brought everyone to this table.
Yeah, and I mean, in Germany, Germany has a very complex relationship with Russia, but Chancellor Merkel does not have a complex relationship with Russia. Mm-hmm. She dislikes Putin. She's been tough on Russia. She was essentially given the task by President Obama of handling the Ukrainian issue. She's never made any kind of doubt where she stands. I think more interesting is the larger number of countries who did it. And if you look at the countries who didn't expel people, they tended to be the smaller Eastern European countries who still are afraid of Russia and are still worried about what Russia could do to them. But the major central countries in the alliance and in the European Union joined this action, and I think that's a very important point.
Michael Crowley, I'd like to get you in on this conversation and just give me your first response and what you're thinking about in the wake of these expulsions.
Well, I'm thinking about this dramatic contrast between the Trump administration's deeds and President Donald Trump's own words and interactions with Russian President Vladimir Putin and the words that Donald Trump does not speak, and the degree to which there seems to be a widening gap between U.S. policy toward Russia and President Trump's personal diplomacy. So in the past weeks and even months, we have seen a steady strengthening of America's posture toward Russia. This goes back, you can look back 2 weeks when the Trump administration imposed a bunch of sanctions on Russians, carrying out a measure that the Congress had passed last summer to punish Russian election interference and also some what appears to have been some hacking into our power grid. Several weeks or a couple of months before that, President Trump approved the sale of defensive weapons to the government of Ukraine to help fight against Russian aggression in Ukraine's east. Barack Obama was pressed by some of his senior national security advisors to give Ukraine sort of heavier military equipment and always declined on the grounds that it was a dangerous escalation. So there have been significant policy steps. At the same time, we continue to see this pattern from President Donald Trump dating back to the earliest days of his candidacy for president, in which he himself never personally criticizes Vladimir Putin. He will occasionally say somewhat critical words about Russia. It's rare and it's usually hedged. He continues to qualify or be vague about Russian culpability for the 2016 election interference. And in all the specific examples I just mentioned, Trump himself has not come out and made a public statement. We all know what his Twitter feed looks like and the number of people he lashes out against, the posturing, the sort of chest beating, the braggadocio. No sign of any of this on his Twitter feed. So I find that contrast quite puzzling. We can talk a little more about why it might be the case, but that's what I'm thinking about.
All right. Well, that's a really interesting point to bring up, and I want to play some tape from President Trump. Here he is speaking to reporters at the White House on March 15th about the poisoning attack in Britain shortly after his administration announced new sanctions on Russia, Russian entities for meddling in the 2016 presidential election. He's been silent on the U.S.'s expulsion of 60 Russian diplomats, but here he was on March 15th.
But do you think Putin was behind this, Mr. President?
It looks like it. I spoke with the Prime Minister, and we are in deep discussions, a very sad situation. It certainly looks like the Russians were behind it. Something that should never, ever happen. And we're taking it very seriously, as I think are many others.
So that's President Trump on March 15th. John Kornblum, respond to Michael Crowley's point. I mean, what do you make of what appears to be a sort of, I guess, dual track? I mean, a tough position coming out of the White House, but not necessarily tough rhetoric coming from the president.
Yeah, well, I think, as has been said, I think that there are two things. First, there is the track of relations with the allies and especially with the British. And the British have treated this as an extremely important issue. And the other Europeans, interestingly enough, even though they're already they're all at the same time debating whether Britain is going to leave the European Union, the other European allies gathered behind them right away and supported them. So the United States really had very little option here but to do this. And I think, as your report shows, you have on the one hand the structure, the diplomatic military structure of the United States taking steps, and then the president not seeming to want to comment on them or to give them strong support or whatever the right word is. So I think you probably do have a dual track here. But the fact is that the United States still was able to take this decision, which was approved by the president, and we have stood firmly behind our British friends and our European allies in sending this message to Moscow.
We're talking about the West's big concerted action against Russia and how the U.S. is playing a part in that push. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Jason, who's calling from Dearborn, Michigan. Jason, you're on the air. Go ahead. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. My question is, what's in it for Russia, essentially? So they do these hacks, and then they did this poisoning, and then unsurprisingly, they get caught by other nations. And then when they're caught, they say, well, it's everybody against us, everybody. They're telling themselves and telling their nation it's us against them. And I've never heard anybody say why Russia would do that. What's in it for them?
Good question. Let me come to you, Michael Crowley, first on that. It's true that President Putin does have this position that it is the West against him.
Yes. And I think an important question is whether Putin takes that position because he really believes it or for domestic consumption. And so there is one school of thought which says that Russia's economy is fundamentally weak. It's chained to the global price of oil. It's hugely dependent on energy exports, oil exports, natural gas. And when those prices and its economy is at the mercy of fluctuations in those prices, and Putin has done very little to modernize, diversify, and strengthen his economy, and therefore Russia's economy is in pretty rough shape. And to distract people from the resulting sort of malaise in the country, Putin has whipped up a kind of nationalism, created a siege mentality, tapped some of the old Cold War themes to rally the public around him as a strong leader and make people feel that he is defending the country and restoring its honor, even if he's not increasing their incomes or their standard of living dramatically. So is he sort of cooking this up for political gain? The other possibility is that Putin is a hardened Cold Warrior who was a spy during the Cold War, was horrified at the way it ended, has called the collapse of the Soviet Union I believe, the greatest tragedy or one of the greatest tragedies in history, and genuinely believes that Russia was humiliated at the end of the Cold War, is disrespected and threatened by the West, and that Russia has to take strong measures to defend itself.
Mm-hmm.
And a school, the third school of thought is essentially he's leading a criminal enterprise that has no vision or theory except sort of bullying and self-preservation. And I think that's somewhere in between the two. But it's hard to know for sure.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is calling from Kent, Ohio. Jim, it's good to have you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm concerned that we've jumped to conclusions without any investigation in this matter, without any proof, no evidence whatsoever that Russia had anything to do with it. And there's many other suspects. I mean, Ukraine could have done it just to trigger a war between NATO and Russia.
So, Jim, when you're saying no evidence, you're talking about no evidence that the Russians were behind the poisoning of this former Russian spy,
right, exactly.
Sergei Skripal,
yeah,
and his daughter, Yulia, right, okay, in England. Well, let me put that
question. No evidence whatsoever.
Okay, well, let me put that up. John Kornblum, let me put that to you. Britain and the Western allies are convinced that Russia was responsible. Is there any doubt in your mind that Russia was, in fact, responsible?
There's no doubt in my mind that the British are careful and competent. And I know how these systems work. I was part of it for a long time. And I know that this has all been checked out by the British with the CIA, NSA, whoever, with the other European services. And I think that it's incorrect to say there's no evidence whatsoever. There's lots of evidence. Secondly, of course, there can always be a mistake. I wouldn't never say that there can't be. But this looks, you know, we have in American legals terminology beyond a reasonable doubt. And right now, I think that it is beyond a reasonable doubt that the Russians are responsible for this. And I think it is beyond a reasonable doubt that the whatever Putin's motives were, and I think Mr. Crowley's discussion was exactly right. Probably Putin's motives are all three of those things that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I think that whatever his motives were, that he has really, really hit the West where it hurts, and the West has responded very dramatically and strongly. That is the real bottom line of this issue. And I personally think that they are responsible for it. But even if they weren't, the West has just decided enough is enough.
Enough is enough. Michael Crowley, same question to you. I mean, I gather one of the pieces of evidence is the nerve agent that was used to poison this former Russian spy and his daughter sort of had a made in Russia label, as it were.
Right. I believe it's, I may bungle the pronunciation, but Novichok or something similar is the name of this nerve agent. It's extremely sophisticated, very small number of labs that would be able to pull it off. I do believe that there's an even more specific fingerprint that that excludes almost any source other than Russia's military establishment. You know, the Russian government itself has been pointing its finger in all kinds of directions, saying that maybe the United States did this, even suggesting that there was no attack whatsoever. The whole thing is fabricated. The Russians are eagerly putting out lots of counter-narratives. The probability seems very low. I would just say there is one thing we should keep in mind, which is, you know, there have been interviews with scientists who were part of the Russian program, and I think this is consistent with past reporting or findings in the U.S. government, that there was concern that some of this material might have leaked out or been stolen from Russia labs during the chaos that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think even Theresa May, in her initial statement, allowed for the possibility that Russian culpability could include Russia having lost control of some of this material. And, you know, it's, I would say, not outside the realm of possibility that maybe rogue military elements who had a grudge against this guy or organized crime figures who were acting on someone's behest might have carried this out, as opposed to a Kremlin-directed operation by Russian military intelligence. But even in that case, it is not the Ukrainians doing it. It is not the British doing it. It is not the Americans doing it. And I do think the overwhelming opinion of Western intelligence services is that this was directed by the Kremlin. But I do think there is that other sort of small probability scenario.
Mm. John Kornblum, I want to sort of come back to you and talk about the opportunity for some kind of improvement here. As we mentioned in the introduction, you go back a long way. You remember, obviously, you were there during the Cold War. We had detente in the Cold War. I'm just wondering what it takes. What's your view of what it would take to sort of reestablish a kind of relationship of constructive engagement between the West and Russia? And are you at all optimistic that that could happen?
Actually, I'm optimistic. I think it will happen sooner or later, partially because just as the Cold War ended, the Russian leadership came to the conclusion that they couldn't keep up the pressure anymore. And this was a whole different kind of pressure, of course. But it's true. I mean, the era, which is now known as detente, started just a couple of years after Czechoslovakia was invaded by Russia. But it depends on leadership. And let's see if we have any leadership either in Russia or in the West.
All right. Michael Crowley, John Kornblum, stand by. We're trying to figure out what happens next in this standoff between Russia and the West and whether this will prove to be a watershed moment. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the new standoff with Russia with Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and with John Kornblum, former Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs and former Deputy U.S. Ambassador to NATO, among many other positions. Let's go right back to the phones and go to Laurie, who's calling from Westport, Maine. Laurie, it's good to have you. What's on your mind? You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Anthony. I was calling about this. I think expelling diplomats is a good start, but not necessarily all of them. Without diplomacy, I'm not sure what's left. But I was wondering about the possibility of freezing bank accounts or exposing offshore tax havens of people, expanding the Magnitsky Act, and...
So upping, ratcheting up economic pressure on the Russian government.
Economic pressure, yeah. Hit them where it hurts. It really enraged Putin the last time the Magnitsky Act was passed, and he responded with the whole adoption freeze, and I think that would be a good way to put additional pressure on it without endangering diplomacy.
Okay, Laurie, I really appreciate the call. We're going to put that on the table. Let me go first to Bill with one more call, who's calling from Ashland, Wisconsin. Bill, it's good to have you. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Anthony. I think that people in America and in the West have no idea what kind of man Vladimir Putin is. He's not really the president of Russia. He's a dictator. He's a gangster. He's got cozy ties with organized crime that deals in drugs in St. Petersburg, where he's from. He uses political murder in a widespread way in his country and outside of his country to silence serious critics of his. He's used the secret police, the FSB, and the MVD probably to carry out political murders. He uses a man named Ramzan Kadyrov, who's the dictator of Chechnya, who's got a 80,000-man personal army.
Bill, we take the point that you don't like Putin, but in terms of this discussion, how should the West respond?
Well, I think the main thing the West needs to do is maintain a massive negative public relations campaign at every level against this man, including exposing all of his corrupt activities and the fact that he has stolen billions of rubles of state assets from the former Soviet Union, and so has that small clique of men that surround him, guys like Petrushev and Bestrykin and Igor Sechin. These are all criminals and gangsters and murderers.
Bill, we got it. We got the point. So let me bring this up in a broad way with our panel. Michael Crowley, we had a couple of calls there. I mean, first was ratcheting up economic pressure on the Putin regime. And then, as you heard, the last caller, you know, really calling him out for some of his allegedly unsavory activities.
Well, there is a school of thought that the only way you can really get to Putin and change his behavior is to squeeze the people who influence him, the oligarchs, the powerful billionaires in his orbit, much harder. That has proven very difficult to do. United Kingdom is a great example. London is absolutely stuffed with property owned by Russian billionaires who love to spend time there. Gives them a place to park their money. It gives them a kind of class and legitimacy. And that's a big project, but it may be the necessary next step. As far as, the true nature of Putin, there's a lot of things one can say, but it gives me an opportunity to make a very important point I neglected to make in the beginning, which is when we compare the U.S.'s deeds with Donald Trump's words, bear in mind the most striking data point when it comes to Trump is that after Vladimir Putin overwhelmingly won a presidential election with 76% of the vote that was widely condemned as anti-democratic, not free, not fair. The media was completely stacked in Putin's favor. Donald Trump called Vladimir Putin and, against the advice and the talking points he had been given by his national security aides, congratulated him on what many people see as a totally illegitimate victory. So there's no secret about Putin's true character, I think, around the world and to anyone who's paying attention. But very curiously, Donald Trump continues to refuse to acknowledge it in any kind of public way or in his interpersonal reactions with Putin.
John Kornblum, I want to ask you about a sort of change in the Trump administration in the name of John Bolton, who will be replacing General McMaster as National Security Advisor. Bolton has been a strong critic of Mr. Putin, calling Russian interference in the 2016 election a true act of war. What does this portend for the future of relations between Russia and the U.S. and the Trump administration's attitude toward Moscow?
Well, you've seen the public reaction to Mr. Bolton's nomination. It hasn't been very positive because he has a long record in Washington, a long record of being a hardliner, a long record also of being pretty brutal with people who don't agree with him. And so the point I think you're making is that Bolton's, at least on the record history, is quite different from the approach that the president seems to be taking to Russia, or that, in fact, the president's campaign rhetoric about not getting involved in foreign wars anymore. So there's another point of confusion, I would say, in the American government. And I would just make the one point that right now, the biggest problem we have is that there's no American leadership on this. Russia is not the country it was in 1970 or 1980. It is not a big power keeping half of Europe under its control. It's a economically weak, large country which has lots of nuclear weapons. This is a situation made for good and strong diplomacy. The problem is, not just now, but in recent years, the United States hasn't really had a very clear approach to Russia, and so it's been allowed to drift. And Putin has been able to take a very great advantage out of this situation.
Well, boy, Michael Crowley, I'd like to get a final word for you in literally the 10 or 15 seconds that remains. Is there a danger that where we are gets worse and could even lead, I don't know, to something hotter involving missiles, rockets? I mean, what are your biggest fears?
Absolutely. Escalation can take on a logic of its own, and particularly if you have some kind of an accident, a couple of planes colliding on the eastern border of Europe or in Syria, for instance, and things can get out of control fast, particularly when you have with Putin and Trump two guys who kind of have a chip on their shoulder and really never want to lose face.
Oh, boy. Well, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, thank you so much for your wisdom on this. We're grateful to have you.
Thank you.
And John Kornblum, former Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, former Deputy U.S. Ambassador to NATO, thank you so much for your time. We're very grateful.
My pleasure.
Listeners, in a moment, we're going to remember the Kansas girl at the center of the 1954 desegregation case, the landmark case. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. Thank you. Linda Brown, whose name will forever be linked to the landmark desegregation case Brown versus Board of Education, has died. As a young girl, Brown's father objected when she was barred from attending an all-white school in her neighborhood in Topeka, Kansas. That would lead to the landmark Supreme Court decision that desegregated, that segregated schools were inherently unequal. Joining us now to help us remember her legacy is Dr. Tiffany Anderson. She's superintendent of Topeka Public Schools. And Dr. Anderson, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also from Bloomington, Indiana, we're joined by Kevin Brown. He's professor at the Maurer School of Law at Indiana University. Professor Brown, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thank you too, Anthony.
So, Professor Brown, I'm going to start with you. How do we remember Linda Brown?
Well, I think you've got to remember her as a great pioneer. Brown versus Board of Education, while it might not have been in the long term as effective as we wanted to be in school desegregation, was a transformative case for American society.
In what way?
Well, it really was the one that opened up our society to desegregation. So it's not just at the elementary and secondary level, but it's also at the collegiate level. It helped to lead towards more integration in jobs and occupations, in the political process. You know, for all practical purposes, this is the moment that the civil rights era really, truly began.
Hmm. And Tiffany Anderson, Dr. Tiffany Anderson, you're the superintendent of Topeka Public Schools. Linda Brown's mission, if you will, started right there in Topeka. What are you thinking about today as you recall Linda Brown?
You know, it's an amazing legacy. Even myself, I'm the first African-American female superintendent in Topeka, and I started a year ago, and I stand on the shoulders of Linda Brown, the Brown family, and many others also stand on their shoulders. And so today is a time in which we, as a district, are remembering not only Linda Brown, but the Brown family, and really what this legacy means for us. We took a moment of silence at 9 a.m., in remembrance of, you know, a 9-year-old student who courageously helped transform education across the nation. So it's an important time. Also, the fact that it's, you know, the month in which we highlight women's history this month. Her birth date was during the month in which we highlight Black history in February. I mean, it is there's so many significant moments right now for us as a community.
Dr. Anderson, I'm wondering if you can take us back. I mean, and Dr. Brown, the same to you. I mean, to imagine what this young girl faced when her father took her by the hand and essentially walked her to an all-white school in her neighborhood and obviously knew that she wasn't going to be allowed to enroll. Can you just, you know, try to sort of imagine what that must have been like for this little girl? I'll start with you, Tiffany Anderson.
Well, you know, it's hard for, I think, any of us who did not live or walk in her shoes to really imagine what it is like to walk in the shoes of someone at that time that that faced many challenges. I can tell you at this time, at this moment in history, as we have continued to look at schools across the nation that where youth are voicing their opinions about inequities in school, that for me really brings it home to what this work is about, that Linda Brown started truly as a pioneer, as was already said, a movement that we must continue. And I think that's important. Even the thought that she was 9 years old, and we're looking right now at youth advocating for things they believe in. And so I think social justice and equity issues certainly are before us now. And her legacy should give us the courage and the passion to fight and advocate in ways that we have to do if we're going to continue to transform systems long term.
Kevin Brown, can you bring us back to that time and just remind us of sort of what was at stake in this legal case?
Well, so you have to go back to 1954, and this is the time when people of African descent were called Negro or colored out of respect or coon, darky, and even black as an insult. Discrimination based on race and employment, merchandising, stores, eating establishments, places of entertainment, hotels and motels was an accepted fact of life. Black people didn't occupy positions above most menial levels in American business and corporations, and indeed even lower level management positions were unobtainable. It was a time where you only had a handful of blacks who were attending prestigious colleges and universities. No man of color had been elected mayor of a major U.S. city in the 20th century, and only four were serving in Congress. None of them had been elected from the 11 states that made up the Confederacy since 1900. So we really are talking about a moment in time that then just reverberates with ripples all the way to today.
Wow. Tiffany Anderson, you know, I'm reading a very thoughtful piece in the New York Times, remembering Linda Brown, and I just want to read this graph to you and ask you where we are today. Her family was among several that reopened the original Brown case in 1979 to argue that the job of integration in Topeka remained incomplete. The case resulted in the opening of several magnet schools. So where are we in Topeka, in particular, today in terms of this issue?
Well, you know, I started with the fact that here we are now in 2018, and I am the first African-American female superintendent in Topeka. So we continue to say that we have a road ahead. However, Topeka is a diverse, innovative a place today because of those steps that were taken by Linda Brown's family and many others. So we have a third African American, a third white, a third Hispanic in our schools, and so we are very mixed in that regard. Our graduation rate in Topeka, unlike other large urban areas, has a gap, but not a significant gap. In our case, you know, our students that are African-American compared to the graduation rates of our white students are within about 6% of each other. And so, you know, if you're at a school and the graduation rate is 92%, then our African-American students, in fact, at the school that I'm talking about has 100% African-American graduation rate for African-American males. At other schools, if your graduation rate is at, you know, 78 or percent, then you're going to have potentially our African-American and white population fairly close. That is not seen across the nation. So Topeka really is on the move in some very powerful ways because of the leaders that have come before us.
And Kevin Brown, sorry to cut you off there, Tiffany Anderson. Kevin Brown, in the literally 15 seconds that remain, final thoughts on the road ahead and the work that remains to be done as we remember the passing of Linda Brown.
There's certainly a lot of work ahead to be done. There's no question about that. But I do think that American society has a right to congratulate itself for the tremendous progress that we have made since 1954.
And that's a good thing to do on this day as we remember the passing of Linda Brown, symbol of the landmark desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education. Kevin Brown, professor at Maurer School of Law, Indiana University, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Tiffany Anderson, Superintendent of Public Schools in Topeka, Kansas. Dr. Anderson, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
That's it this hour. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.